Welcome to the Internet History Podcast. I'm your host, Brian McCullough. Mark Tarpening, along with Martin Eberhard, was the co-founder of Tesla Motors all the way back in 2003. But before that, Tarpening and Eberhard were also the co-founders of Nuvo Media, which produced one of the world's first ever ebook devices, the Rocket ebook. So for the first part of this great episode, Mark recounts the story of Nuvo Media, and then about 25 minutes in, we begin the founding of Tesla, which is, in my opinion, perhaps the most amazing startup story of the last 20 years. Very rarely have we spoken to an entrepreneur who has so completely disrupted two completely different analog industries, as Mark has been privileged to do in his career. So please enjoy this conversation with Mark Tarpening. Mark Tarpening, thanks for coming on the Internet History Podcast.
My pleasure.
There's so much I want to cover with you today, so I only want to dip briefly into the early part of your career, but I believe early on in your career, you worked at a lot of disk drive startups, is that right?
Yeah, well, actually, you know, when I graduated Berkeley in 86, and then, or 85, I guess, and then I ended up going to Saudi Arabia for years. Mm-hmm. So I was orbiting the planet every six to 12 weeks. I had round the world tickets, actually. So I really did orbit the planet, doing work on computers in Riyadh in Saudi Arabia. And when I came back to Silicon Valley, I ended up in the way that Silicon Valley works. I was at a party, and one of the people there worked at a disk drive company, that was a startup stealth disk drive company. And they said, oh, you know, we were looking for somebody. You got to come just check us out. And then I ended up working there for a couple of years. They were doing the very first of the sort of small drives, 2.5-inch diameter drives, the ones you might see in a laptop. Mm-hmm. And at that time, that was very hard to do.
I asked you that because I wonder if there were lessons working at startups like that would apply later to what we're about to talk about.
Oh, yeah. So, you know, first off, there's the whole sort of startup idea where, you know, you get stock and you work for these little companies and nobody has any resources and you're all very scrappy. And that sort of ethic and that culture was very important and certainly informed everything else that I did. But also, in disk drives are kind of interesting because it's very multidisciplinary because you have magnetics people. You have media people that are actually, you know, in this case, magnetic media. The analog engineers dealing with the read channels, mechanical engineers, you know, with the physical stuff, servo engineers, which is a special, you know, control systems part of software, and then the sort of firmware people that make the data flow in and out in a controlled way. So it was a very neat project because you had all of these very deep specialties. And it was a great example of how software is eating everything, that the mechanical complexity in disk drives, if you look at a modern disk drive versus one from, you know, the 1970s, the modern disk drive with, you know, tons more density is mechanically super simple. And it's super simple because software has been able to take over all of those functions. And it's much, much cheaper to do it in software, obviously, than precision hardware.
Well, I think software and hardware, that tie-in that you just talked about, is going to be very important here in a second. Tell me about meeting Martin Eberhard.
So one of these trips back from the Middle East, I was visiting my high school and actually my high school friend and college roommate who was working at a company called, I think he was at NCD, and that was a startup dealing with networked terminals. So, you know, Stone Age technology, but at the time, you know, very innovative. And Martin was one of the co-founders there, and was essentially my friend's boss. So I met him, you know, through through my friend Greg, who, parenthetically, I just had lunch with about an hour ago.
So, I guess you hit it off with Martin?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. We have very similar ideas on things, and he's, you know, I'm a software guy, and he's a hardware guy, so you know, you kind of need both to make things happen.
Yeah, it's sort of that perfect yin and yang. So what is the genesis of Nuvo Media? Is it that you guys decide you want to do some sort of a company together, or how does the idea start to form?
Yeah, so we decided we wanted to do a company together. That would be very fun. You know, I was doing this, you know, disk drive stuff, and he actually got sucked into a little bit of that as well, because I think it was at one of his friends' parties that I was. That's how I ended up getting sucked in. So he came and worked at a couple different companies for just a short period of time, doing some consulting on the electrical side. And then we said, you know, let's go do something ourselves. But we didn't know what to do. Of course, we had a bunch of ideas, and we quickly decided that we needed to do something that we actually knew something about. So, for example, we knew what disk drives were doing, and we knew what silicon was doing, and we knew we could see the sort of progress. So one of the things that we realized was that you were going to be able to record video onto hard drives, which, you know, wasn't really possible only, you know, 6 months before, and it was just going to become possible. So you could make a digital video recorder, you know, so you could record TV on, you know, you didn't have to use videotape. That tape were those, you know, spinny things that that people used to have in these giant cartridges. So we thought, well, that would be great. The only problem is neither of us owned a TV. So we actually, since we didn't watch TV, you know, we kept talking about it. I said, well, you know, we don't ever use this product. You know, it's got to be something we actually use. So we went through a couple of different iterations of different things. And of course, at that same time, there was a group of people making TiVo. You know, they were almost at exactly the same moment going, oh, wow, this is just possible. Mm-hmm. And they founded TiVo, you know, like a few weeks later, I think. So we decided that the thing that we really like to do is read lots of books. And books, we had books everywhere. So we thought, oh, well, that's perfect. We can, you know, the technology is becoming available. We could display those books on screens. I mean, it sounds ridiculous now, but at the time, again, we had lots of resistance. People said, no one's ever going to read on a screen. You know, it's one thing to read an email, but they're never going to read a book on a screen.
Well, also, it should be pointed out that this is around the same time that Palm Pilots are coming out and people are
exactly.
using. So it's this notion that pocket devices are finally becoming a thing. This is around, like, what, 97, 98?
Correct, 97, yeah. So, yeah, the Palm Pilot was, you know, we obviously used that in our pitch decks to say, you know, this stuff is going to happen. I mean, people really are going to have these digital devices. And, you know, obviously it's going to take a larger screen to really read a book, you know, effectively. But it's going to be possible. We're going to be able to distribute the books, you know, over this internet thing. And we're going to be able to get the digital content from the publishers, which turned out to be incredibly difficult. The publishing industry is super old. They've been around for hundreds and hundreds of years. They have a whole special set of laws that apply only to them. And many of the same people, like you go into these companies that are 200 years old, and the same people are running them, you know, and they don't like change so much. So it was extremely hard to get the media, you know, to get content into digital form. And we had to create, you know, we had to spend millions literally with lawyers creating whole new ideas around how that happens, the way that books are licensed, which is what, you know, is the standard now, but at the time, you know, none of that existed.
So the product you launch is called the Rocket eBook.
Right.
I believe it retailed around $500 maybe and weighed about 1.25 pounds. Well, give me some of the specs that you remember. Like how many books could I store on the initial Rocket eBook?
Oh my gosh, that's I don't actually remember. So certainly like 10 or 20 on each device. And obviously you could then it plugged in, you know, to a computer. So you could keep a library of, you know, sort of unlimited size on your computer. Remember, this is at a time when dial up was the dominant means of dealing with the internet. So, you know, the common, you know, paradigm was that, you know, you would buy something online, although even online was kind of a novel concept. You would download the content onto your computer, and then you would transfer it over to your electronic book, there, you know, the book itself didn't have wireless built in or anything. That was really not possible.
Right, because Wi-Fi isn't ubiquitous yet. Cell phones probably don't even have 40% market penetration at that point.
Well, right, and they don't have data.
Right.
You know, that you can't, you know, you can text to a cell phone, but you know, you're not, you can't really transmit data that way. So.
And so also it's an LCD screen. It's not the e-ink screen that we're used to with Kindles, but even that was something like that was just suddenly available. Like having a screen that was able to be sharp enough to function as a reader was something that you were on the cutting edge of.
Yeah, in fact, at that time, and I think it's probably still the case, all the best displays come from Japan. And so we had to go to Japan and, you know, work our way into all the various, you know, the Samsungs, I mean, the Sharps and Sonys to see their latest stuff that wasn't on the market yet, because nothing on the market was good enough. You couldn't really read on it. The contrast ratio wasn't high enough, and these were all black and white screens, remember. You know, color really, the color screens were, you know, terrible at the time. You know, nobody could read on those. So we finally found a screen made by Sharp that used it's called DMTN. It's a kind of LCD panel that was unusual, that had very, very high contrast ratio for the time. It was, you know, it was like about 10x what anything else had. And they had developed it for a client to make a particular kind of golf computer that never really took off, but they spent millions and millions and millions of dollars developing this technology and wanted to find another market for it. And, you know, it was a perfect fit. And it was the thing that actually, once people saw it, you know, we had all these meetings, and they would say, "Oh, you know, no one's going to read on a screen, blah 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 blah." And then we would hand them, you know, one of the few sort of handmade prototypes that we had, and they would look at it and go, "Oh my gosh, this is going to be big," because before that, nobody had seen anything quite like that.
Mm-hmm. I read that, you know, and this would have been obvious in 1997, 1998, that you went really hard at Amazon to try to get Amazon to buy in as an investor. But didn't have any luck.
Well, sort of, yeah. No, we did. We actually had a couple of great meetings with Jeff, and he's, you know, totally great. And we came to terms. You know, we had, you know, sort of a deal for an investment. And at that time, Amazon was really worried about Barnes & Noble. It was, you know, Amazon was quite small. Barnes & Noble was the big bookseller, the biggest bookseller on earth at the time, and they were going to go into digital, or, you know, they were going to go into online and basically destroy Amazon, was what everybody believed. Which, you know, it's hard to imagine now, but that was what looked like it was going to happen. So they were very concerned about Barnes & Noble. And so, you know, we came to a deal for an investment. You know, just an investment, it's a Series A investment, or Series B, perhaps, I can't remember now. We then started, you know, when you get these things, you know, the person says, yes, here's the terms, and then the lawyers get at it. And we could not close the deal with the lawyers. The lawyers were, you know, the lawyer that he had. We just couldn't get a deal. The terms would come back completely different than what Jeff had said. And so meanwhile, we want to close around. And then we went and talked to Barnes & Noble. And because we figured, well, if Jeff's really afraid of Barnes & Noble, then we should go to Barnes & Noble and see what's going on there. And they also said, you know, no one's going to read on screens, blah, blah, blah. And then they saw our demo. now I'm blanking on the head of Barnes & Noble's name.
The Riggios?
Yeah, the Riggios. Steve Riggios looked at it, and he's like, oh my gosh, this is really potentially, you know, big. And they were in. And they said, you know, you can ask anyone, you know, in the publishing industry, if we say these are the terms and this is the deal, it's done. Hmm. And sure enough, I mean, their lawyers beavered away, you know, I don't know, for a week. And we had a perfect term sheet and perfect, you know, legal documents that all matched exactly what we had spoken, and the deal was closed. And it was just because Jeff's lawyer was incredibly, not bad, but he had a very different agenda than I think Jeff Bezos did. And what was interesting is we were going to be his first sort of Amazon's first investment in a startup. And we ran into two other people over the years that were also in that position, and they had exactly the same experience. They made the deal with Jeff, and then the lawyer, it was just terrible, and they could never close the deal, and they ended up getting money from somebody else. And then that lawyer got fired, because Jeff is extremely quantitative. So I'm sure the first time he said, oh, flaky, you know, entrepreneurs. The second time he probably said, interesting, happening, it just happened again. Must be, you know, I must have just gotten unlucky. And then the third time when it happened, he said, the one common denominator is the lawyer. and then he closed, you know, then he invested in like 12 companies in a row very successfully. But
when you go through airport security, there's one line where the TSA agent checks your ID and another line where a machine scans your bag. The same thing happens in enterprise security, but instead of passengers and luggage, it's end users and their devices. These days, most companies are pretty good at the first part of the equation where they check user identity. But user devices can roll right through authentication without getting inspected at all. In fact, 47% of companies allow unmanaged, untrusted devices to access their data. That means an employee can log in from a laptop that has its firewall turned off and hasn't been updated in 6 months, or worse, that laptop might belong to a bad actor using employee credentials. Collide finally solves the device trust problem. Collide ensures that no device can log into your Okta-protected apps unless it passes your security checks. Plus, you can use Collide on devices without MDM, like your Linux fleet, contractor devices, and every BYOD phone and laptop in your company. Visit collide.com/ride to watch a demo and see how it all works. That's KOLIDE.com/ride, collide.com/ride. Let's be real for a minute. Most guys would wear a t-shirt every day of their lives if they could. The problem is that most t-shirts are not acceptable to wear at work or out on a hot date night. But today's sponsor, Cuts, has finally changed that. Cuts t-shirts are such high quality, wrinkle-free, and so buttery soft that you can look like you're dressing up even when you're dressing down. Yeah, you heard that. Wrinkle-free. You never have to substitute comfort for fashion ever again. If you see me in a t-shirt, it's likely one from Cuts. I'm also a huge fan of their AO five-pocket pants, the right sort of step-up from jeans without going all the way into dress pants, like literally my ideal Venn diagram of professional-looking but comfortable feeling. When you touch something from Cuts, you can immediately feel the quality. Their proprietary fabric blends are ridiculously soft and breathable, they don't wrinkle, and they look way more expensive than they actually are. For a limited time, our listeners get 20% off your entire order when you use code RIDE at checkout. That's 20% off your order at cutsclothing.com with promo code RIDE. Please support our show and tell them we sent you. Experience the perfect blend of style and comfort with Cuts Clothing. cutsclothing.com, promo code RIDE for 20% off.
Do you you don't have to, but do you remember those two other companies that missed with Amazon as well?
No, I don't know.
Okay.
It
would be with retrospect and knowing now that ebooks didn't really seriously go mainstream until the Kindle, to say that maybe Rocket ebook was too early. But I mean, I, you know, found numbers like you sold 20,000 units in the first year, were doing double that the second year. And, you know, by like 1999, you have like the base model cost down to like $169. So it was a pretty successful early entrant into this market, right?
Well, I think so. I mean, you know, I think you can argue that our, you know, the timing was probably, we were a little bit ahead of the market, because, you know, the Kindle comes out years later. And by that time, the people were used to buying online. By that time, the publishers were used to having content online. You know, all the pieces had sort of come into play. So you can argue that our market timing was off. Also, you know, when we got the opportunity to sell the company, it was sort of an unsolicited offer from Genstar TV Guide. It was at a very high number. And we knew we were going to have to go raise money again in the next few, you know, months, or, you know, we had recently closed around, so we were, you know, okay for a while, but as we were ramping up, and then we get this unsolicited offer, and it would make all the investors happy. And this was in 2000, and, you know, things were getting a little squirrely. I mean, you know, the bubble, it was becoming apparent that all was not well on the financing front. So we worked very hard to close that deal, and we thought genuinely that they had a plan for digital publishing. They knew the TV guide was sort of fading away because of online guides, and they had an interesting plan. I wouldn't say it would have been successful, but they had a reasonable plan. And then, of course, a few months later, Rupert Murdoch takes control of the company. And, he's not particularly interested in electronic books at that point. He has other things to go do. So, it sort of failed in that front. But on the other hand, we had a successful exit. The technology, that particular product didn't succeed. But I think we did push, we were part of the enabling technologies or the enabling legal framework and everything else that allowed then later, the Kindle to be successful. And, I read many of my books, of course, now either on a Kindle or my iPad. Mm-hmm. And every time I do, I say, I was a small part of that game.
Before we leave Nouveau Media, you had mentioned that working with the publishing industry and negotiating some of the first, digital royalty agreements and things like that, this is also sort of around the Napster era. So weren't they aware of that? Wouldn't they be eager to play a role?
Oh my gosh, were they aware of Napster? That was they were terrified. And so what they were very concerned with was getting any of their intellectual property essentially in digital form. So you cannot imagine, coming from Silicon Valley, it was difficult to really wrap your mind around the fact that even in the late 90s or in 97, most books were not digitally typeset. They never were really in digital form in a normal sense. So a common thing would be somebody would submit a manuscript, literally, handwritten or typed, like with a typewriter. Then they would key it into some sort of machine. I'm not even sure what it was, and then they would typeset it. But that would produce films that would then these sort of large negatives would get produced. The large negatives, they had artists that would go and touch up these large negatives even, because they'd make correct, they would even be editing the book after it had sort of gotten to photographic print. So then they would go and actually change, they would make edits on the negatives themselves. And then they would take these to these presses and they would do the print run. And very often, if there was photographs and stuff that were included in the book, if there were illustrations, those were done in a completely separate process. And then they would be, then they would come together in the binding house and be bound together. And so there was never a moment where that book existed in a digital form that was machine readable in any complete sense. And that was sort of that process I just described was normal. In fact, it was incredibly common for if a second run of the book was needed, if it had been quite a while between the first run and the second run, they would have to literally, because they didn't have it in any reasonable format, they would go and buy a copy of the book. And then I'm not making this up, but buy a couple copies. They would send it to the Philippines. They would have two typists retype the book in. Wow. And then they had a little fancy program that would compare the output of the two typists and find any discrepancies. And then an editor would look and figure out which was the mistake and which wasn't. And then they would repeat the process, and that's how they would do the second edition.
So, so were you guys able to gently nudge them in the direction of just going digital first might save all that hassle?
Well, they didn't. They just weren't set up for it. And so we had this really naive Silicon Valley view that's we'd like the digital files of some book that had come out, then we could format it in some nice way on for our electronic books. And electronic book formatting obviously is a little bit different because the page size and orientation can change. So you can't. Page layout is a very sort of different concept. And they were, they looked at us like we had two heads. They had no idea what we were talking about because, here's these photographs of the pages. Is this, is this the negative of what you want and stuff? So it took them, they knew what it was, they knew they had to get there. But the technical details were only part of it. The legal framework was extremely difficult because the industry has been around for a long time, so there's layers and layers and layers of sort of legal precedent and tradition around it. So it's very common for books to be sold by geographic region, the rights for a book. So you have the North American rights, you have the English language rights for North America, or you have the English language rights for all other countries outside of North America and England, for example, or Great Britain. That's a very common, you know, system. So, like, how are you going to, if somebody on your digital platform is in South Africa and buys it, versus buying it from New, you know, in New York, well, you know, that's two totally separate geographic rights that are negotiated completely separately, and the author owns those rights. You know, sort of all rights not explicitly sold are owned by the author.
In the individual territories. Yeah.
So if the author only sells the rights, for example, to English language in North America, and then somebody buys it in Germany, well, he doesn't, you know, the publisher doesn't have the right to send that file to him, to that person, because they don't own the rights for English language distribution in Germany, for example. So this was, you know, on the internet, you know, this was an incredibly large problem, and these geographic monopolies, basically, that they had. And then on top of that, you don't only sell it, you also sell it by book type, or by what do they call it? I can't even remember the term now. But so, for example, the hardback rights are sold completely separately than the paperback rights, which are sold completely separately than the trade publication rights. So, those individual rights are all independently sliced and diced by geographic region. So now you say digital. Well, the publishers typically don't own those rights at all, at least at that time, because they might have had a contract to do English language North America, but they didn't have the digital rights for it. That was only for the hardback. So the publishing houses, you know, if you wanted to print out, you know, if they wanted to have you publish one of these books of one of their authors, they would have to go back to the author and
renegotiate a whole
new contract, because they don't have the rights to do that. The author still retains that. And a couple of the publishing houses maintain that once they had the hardback rights, that was the same as the digital rights. And they have literally hundreds of years of case law to show that that isn't the case, that in each new format that's come out, the author retains those rights and is expressly given away. And we had one publishing house that was so proud of itself. It says, we knew this was coming. We were sure this was coming. So our whole catalog, we own the digital rights of all of our hardback books, because we buy those we actually negotiate that and we have that. Even though there was no digital distribution, we knew it was coming. So, you know, our whole catalog is it. And we're like, ah, that's so great. So we are like a week from launch when their lawyers call in a total panic saying, all these titles that we're going to do at launch, we can't do any of them because although we own the digital rights, it turns out since we didn't know what digital rights were, there's no payment structure agreed upon in these contracts. So we have to go to every author and get a separate payment agreement before you sell the first one. So they had to go and so, but we eventually got all through that. So you know, I figured that if nothing else, we paid for a lot of the lawyering that allows all of the content to be distributed the way it is now.
Well, thank you for blazing that path. All right, so let's start on the next story then. So you and Martin do have the successful exit to Gemstar TV Guide, and I guess you enjoyed the ride so much that you decide you want to go again and do another company. So what are you guys thinking about when you're thinking of going again?
Well, we looked at a bunch of different things. So one thing we wanted to do, though, was raise the bar a little bit. The last one had been something that, you know, we thought would be fun, and we wanted to meet authors and sort of understand the whole world. And we met some great people, and it was totally fun. It did exactly what we had wanted. The second time around, you know, we wanted something a little bit more meaty, a little bit more meaningful. And we looked at a bunch of different things in terms of, you know, everything from, you know, bizarre lawn sprinklers, you know, that would save water to, you know, all kinds of random stuff. But Martin had this idea of, he'd wanted to buy an electric car. And it was right about the time when the zero emissions mandate got rewritten in Sacramento here in California. So all the electric cars had ceased to exist, and they weren't very good anyway. The EV one was the only one that was kind of viable, and it was all leased, and then, of course, GM took them back and crushed them. And so he was pissed off about that. He says, why don't we just do this electric car thing? You know, it just can't be that hard. And I thought, you know, how are we ever, you know, making a car? Our experience with batteries in the consumer electronics world for the e-books, we knew the batteries were getting better and better and better. And, you know, they had gone from nickel metal, or they had gone really from NiCad to nickel metal hydride and then lithium ion. And that, you know, just in our, you know, sort of experience. And the lithium ion batteries were so much better than the nickel metal hydride batteries. However, they're a little bit more, you know, they're finicky to work with. But, you know, once you understand how to work with them, they're not that bad. And it makes up for it because the energy density is so much higher. So we were sure, you know, with, you know, some spreadsheet calculations that, in fact, you could put enough energy on a car to make it really compelling. I mean, way better than any of these, you know, EV1s or anything else I'd ever imagined. And the rest of it is a computer science problem because it's really just, you know, computers synthesizing waveforms to make motors go, and a network problem because there's lots of little computers required to do all of that. But, you know, that's our world. Like, little computers that control stuff, Silicon Valley is really good at that.
Well, and so, can I also, because remember, the big thing at the time was hydrogen fuel cells and stuff, but you guys do the math and you're like, no, EV is the most efficient way to go if you're trying to improve what a car could be, right?
Correct. If your goal is to reduce energy consumption, or specifically oil consumption, but just, you know, in any given resource, you want to use it as efficiently as possible, right? So, you know, you don't want to pick something that just consumes lots of that for no apparent reason. And hydrogen, you know, is uniquely bad. You know, there's a thing in the auto industry that says hydrogen is the future of transportation and always will be. It's a scam, as far as I can tell, because the energy equation is terrible. It is just terrible, because hydrogen, the proponents always say, oh, but it's the most abundant element in the universe. But it's abundant out there in the universe, not here. We live on a planet. You know, on a planet, all the hydrogen is super reactive. It's bound up into everything. It's bound up into water and wood and everything else. So the only way that you get hydrogen is that you have to pour energy in to make it. You have to break it free from the chemical bonds that it's bound up into. So electrolysis is the most common thing. You know, you put you know, electricity in water and it separates it. But, you know, so you're pouring energy in order to make the hydrogen. And then you have to compress it, and that takes energy. And then you have to transport it to wherever you actually need it, which is, you know, very difficult because hydrogen is actually much harder to work with than gasoline or even natural gas. And natural gas is not that easy. And then you have to convert it ultimately in a car. And then you have this very high pressure vessel in your car, which has its own, you know, danger, safety issues around it. And then on top of that, you have to convert it back into electricity to make the car go, because hydrogen powered cars are really electric cars that just have an extraordinarily bad battery. And because hydrogen it's an energy carrier. It's not a primary fuel source on this planet. I mean, you know, it may be out somewhere in the universe, you know, it might be, but not on terrestrial planets. And so when you add that all up, it turns out that the amount of energy in per kilometer driven is just terrible. I mean, it's way worse than almost anything else that you can come up with, which I've always suspected is one of the reasons why the energy companies have been big proponents of it. And when we were raising money the first time, you know, and we had really carefully gone through all the math to understand fuel cells, because there was a bunch of money going into fuel cells at the time. And also we looked at, you know, biofuels and, you know, ethanol, and, you know, we sort of went down the whole list and figured out, you know, what the most energy efficient system was, which turned out to be battery electric cars, because charging lithium ion batteries is like over 90% efficient, and then discharging them is also over 90% efficient. So, you know, you hardly lose anything in the storage part. But we would go to these VCs and we would say, you know, so we had a whole slide deck on why hydrogen fuel cells were a bad idea. And about half the VCs would get to that slide, and they'd say, oh, skip this. You know, we know it. You know, and actually one of them used the word scam. Oh, we know it's a scam. Just go, you know, we've done the analysis, we know. Mm. And the other half of these users get real quiet and ask lots of questions about it and have us go back over the slides again about the hydrogen fuel cell, because they had, of course, invested in fuel cell, all of which went out of business. Because it just doesn't, for transportation, there are fuel cells that are useful for other things. You know, there's some really funny solid oxide fuel cells. There's ones that are like in the basement of the New York Stock, the stock exchanges, that run on natural gas, and they're used for backup power because they can't use diesel generators in downtown Manhattan. But, you know, there's some specialty things, but for you know, storing energy and driving cars, it's insane because you almost get nothing, you know, for the kilowatt hours you put in.
With everybody fighting for attention, how can your business stand out and connect with customers? Easy. Get Constant Contact. Constant Contact's award-winning marketing platform has helped millions of small businesses stand out, stay top of mind, and see big results fast. Constant Contact makes it easy to promote your business with powerful tools like email and SMS marketing, social media posting, and even events management. With Constant Contact, you'll reach new audiences, grow your customer list, and communicate more effectively to sell more, raise more, and fast-track growth. Don't know much about marketing? No sweat. Constant Contact's writing assistance tools and automation features help you say the right thing at the right time, every time. Plus, you can send with confidence knowing your emails are actually reaching your customers thanks to Constant Contact's best-in-class 97% deliverability rate. I use this, and you should too. Tackle any challenge with Constant Contact's expert live customer support. Plus, everything's backed by their 30-day money-back guarantee, so get going and start growing your business today with a free trial at ConstantContact.com. Just go to ConstantContact.com right now. Constant Contact, helping the small stand tall. ConstantContact.com. We all know there are things in life that you have to compromise on, but when it comes to your health, there is no compromise. So don't go back to that one doctor who uses your appointment to catch up on the latest headlines, their family group chat, their crossword puzzles, just because they're available right now or they take your slightly sketchy insurance. Instead, check out ZocDoc, the place where you can find and book doctors who will make you feel comfortable, listen to you, and prioritize your health. And you can search by location, availability, and insurance, so literally no compromises here, because with ZocDoc, you've got more options than you know. ZocDoc is a free app and website where you can search and compare highly rated in-network doctors near you and instantly book appointments with them online. Once you find the doc you want, you can book them immediately. No more waiting awkwardly on hold with a receptionist. And these docs all have verified reviews from actual real patients. We're talking about booking appointments with tens of thousands of top-rated, patient-reviewed, credible doctors and specialists. I have personally used ZocDoc to find a podiatrist when I needed one for the first time ever in my life. Go to ZocDoc.com/techmeme and download the ZocDoc app for free. Then find and book a top-rated doctor today. That's ZocDoc.com/techmeme. ZocDoc.com/techmeme.
Well, so could I prompt you for two insights? Because to me, I feel like reading about this was key, which is, first of all, actually, so there was recent experience with electronic vehicles, GM's EV1 specifically, and that experiment specifically told you that you could be successful, because the word that I love, or the quote that I love, is that you learn that tree huggers and geeks have a lot of money. So tell me about that insight.
Well, that isn't quite the insight. What was interesting about the EV1 was, you know, GM, not the most, you know, well-loved brand among, you know, the money people. Because, you know, if you're successful, you tend to go buy a Mercedes or a BMW or something. You don't go buy the latest GM vehicle. And when they had the EV1 out there, they only leased them in California, and yet the people who leased them were almost all of them were very wealthy. And it is so, because electric cars are so incredibly energy efficient, they're actually really cheap to drive per mile. You know, the per mile cost is super low. The sort of assumption for a lot of people was that the only reason that you would drive an electric car is because you were super cheap. You wanted to save money on gas. There's also an assumption, and that was widespread, that we were asked that constantly. Well, when will it pay for itself? It was a constant question that the VCs asked.
pay for itself by saving on gas.
You know? By saving on gas. And, of course, you know, it's a $100,000 sports car. You know, it's not nobody, you know, that I would always say, oh, what sports car do you have? And they'd go, oh, I've got a Porsche, you know, 911. I'd say, when will that pay for itself? Oh, well, that, you know, it doesn't pay for itself. No, it's hugely expensive. I'd be like, yeah, exactly. But that's not why you bought it. It wasn't to save money. And that's people don't buy electric cars to save money in general. So the interesting thing was that the people who were buying or leasing, in this case, electric cars in California, were the very top, you know, the top 1%, you know, the people that you read about. They were clearly not trying to save money. Gas was at about $1.50 a gallon at the time. You know, they literally were spending more at Starbucks than they were at the gas station, and yet they were buying electric cars, or they were leasing electric cars. And they were doing it for some other reason. So when we looked at that, they said, well, shoot, you know, a new technology is going to be expensive. We're going to have to come in, you know, at a high point. What can we deliver? What extra value can we deliver? And it turns out electric cars are really, really quick off the dime. And sports cars, that's what you buy a sports car. That's what a sports car is about, is that incredible acceleration that you get. And there's nothing like an electric car in terms of acceleration. It's you know, we had people that would drive, you know, even, you know, drive one of the Model S's now or drive the Roadster at the time, and they would come back and say, you know, you broke my Ferrari, you know, you broke my Porsche. And I'm like, what are you talking about? I said, well, you know, now I get in my very expensive gasoline-powered car, and just so slow, you know, because electric cars have that instant acceleration that's maximum at 0 RPM and stays maximum for a very long time.
And that's similar to the other point that I found fascinating was, because remember, Priuses become a thing around this time, and Toyota discovers a similar thing, that the Prius sales actually cannibalized their Lexus sales. People were trading in their Lexuses for Priuses.
Correct, and that was not their plan. I mean, the Prius was for a whole variety of reasons. You know, they were only sold in California initially. They came out for, you know, in typical Japanese fashion, it's incredibly torturous, you know, political path within Toyota, and they really weren't supposed to sell very well, and they certainly weren't supposed to sell into that particular demographic, And, you know, in downtown Palo Alto here, which is, you know, Palo Alto is a very wealthy, you know, suburb here in Silicon Valley. And literally at that time, every driveway had like a Porsche and a Prius. They had traded in one of their cars, they had traded in that BMW, they had traded in the Lexus, and they had replaced it with a Prius. And it wasn't about saving, you know, money on gas. It was because they didn't want to be consuming gas.
They're for making whatever a statement.
They were making a statement because, you know, all the cars do the same thing, right? If whether you buy a $100,000 car or a $10,000 car, you go the same places. You're going at the same speed, and at least around here, you know, you're rarely even going as fast as, you know, the freeway speeds because the traffic is so bad. So it doesn't, you know, it's not about you're not going to get there twice as fast because you have a sports car. It just doesn't work that way. So. People buy, and yet when anybody has any extra income, they tend to upgrade their car. And part of that is they want to make a statement. It's a reflection of who they are, whether it's the sporty image of the fancy sports car or the conservative image of the Volvo or, you know, whatever it is. But they're really, you know, making a statement. And the wealthier you are, the sort of more flexibility you have to make that statement. And so the wealthy people around here were buying Priuses. They didn't want to be part of the oil economy, or at least they wanted to be less a part of the oil economy. So that was, you know, that was sort of the marketing insight that allowed us to come out with a sports car that was electric.
Right. That's that genius insight that because, you know, so you realize that you can come in at the top of the market, you can come high end, high quality, sexy, flashy. But that also fits what you have to do for your business plan because there's no way you can compete with GM or Ford or anybody like that mass production. You need to start out small, right? So it's this amazing – it fits perfectly what you're going to have to do.
Well, right. And you know, we looked very carefully at what other advantages other than just not using oil did electric drive provide. And that, you know, it turns out that, of course, as you say, it fit perfectly. Electric drive provides extremely rapid acceleration. And it is a great thing is that the the Model D, which is the big sedan, you know, with all-wheel drive, mm-hmm. It has a 0-60 time of 2.8 seconds. So it's faster than the latest Porsche 911 that they just released in North America. And somebody asked the Porsche rep, he said, your Porsche is at 3.8 seconds, 0-60, but the Model, you know, D, the Tesla Model D is 2.8 seconds. It's a second faster. And he's, oh, but that's not fair. You're comparing a sedan and a sports car. And I thought, oh, that's great. You know, like normally you think the sedan would be the slower vehicle, mm-hmm. But of course it's electric, so it's actually faster or quicker in this case. So it worked out that we could come up with a plan, a kind of car, because there was the modeling showed us we could make a whole variety of different cars. You know, in modeling, I mean, you know, Excel spreadsheets. You know,
I want to highlight that. So you're not talking about complex modeling. You're talking about literally just doing the math in Excel.
Well, exactly, and it's all sort of high school math and physics, really. Mm-hmm. Because you just trying to figure, how much energy does it take to accelerate something? You know, how much friction do you have on the wheels, an estimate of the aero drag based on a typical sports car. You know, we didn't have the actual design, but or a typical car, so we put in truck or because an SUV was SUVs were very popular at the time. We thought, well, maybe we could do an SUV. It turned out for a variety of reasons we couldn't really make a compelling SUV at first, And then you know the energy density of the batteries, and you know the gravimetric density, how much energy you can put in per gram. So you can make a pretty good guess of how heavy the vehicle is going to be, and that works out to the acceleration. But it's all sitting there in a spreadsheet, fiddling with these numbers. And the incredible power of math to predict things. You know, we sit there for weeks fiddling with this thing, and we come up with we can make a sports car that would really perform super well. And the price would be about this, and this would be, I think, a really compelling product. And then, 5 years later, when we release it, pretty much we met that specification because, the spreadsheet predicted what was possible through the math. And I think that that's just amazing to me.
Okay, so doing the math is one thing, doing the modeling is one thing, but you guys are software and hardware engineers, but you're not automobile engineers. So, tell me how you get to the point of actually, okay, we're going to have to build a car. We can do can solve the battery things in math. We can solve the software things, but how are we going to make a car?
Well, this was actually my biggest concern with the project. I kept telling Martin, so it's great. I am convinced we can make. We've convinced ourselves. Collectively, that we could do the hardware and the software and the drivetrain. We can do that, and the batteries are good enough and all that. But I just didn't see how we were going to be able to make a car. But then the more that we researched the industry, we discovered that over the previous 30 years, the car industry had completely refactored itself. So it went from being sort of vertically integrated, where the most famous being Ford, which literally would take in iron ore, and produce Model Ts at the other end. To the current model, where basically the car companies simply do final assembly, and they make the engines. They all typically make their own engines, but we don't care about that because that's the last thing we want is an engine. And actually, everything else is done by other companies. So the windshield wiper motors are made by a different. They're all just suppliers. They're suppliers to the final assembly process, and then some of the final assembly is actually completely outsourced as well. So at that time, all the BMW X3s were being made by a company called Magna Steyr in Austria. Mm-hmm. They've never, BMW had very little to do with it. I mean, they did all the Magna Steyr built all the cars. The Saabs were being done by Magna Steyr as well. A couple of the other American car companies that had European versions, Magna was building. So we knew that it was possible to go to a company like Magna and say, okay, here's the drivetrain, and the suppliers are going to be shipping you parts. Can you screw the thing together? Now, Magna tended to only they wanted contracts in the 50,000 cars, that kind of thing, and we knew the Roadster wasn't going to be that volume. So we ended up at Lotus, that had experience making low volume sports cars in it, and had experience doing this outsourced manufacturing because they had done this. For GM, they had made the Opel Speedster for GM, and they had done it. I can't remember the other one, the Vauxhall something or other that they had made for another car company in Europe. So they had a legal structure that could accommodate us, and they had this idea on their line, you know, on their production line. They needed some of the cars they were making were Lotus cars, and then they would either convert the line or, you know, for weeks or whatever their particular
to keep the line running.
But they would do something to keep the line running, but it would be producing another car for a different car company.
Because if you go to, say, a Ford and say, hey, we'd like you to produce a car under our name, there's no way they're going to say yes.
They won't do that. No, right. No. But you know, Lotus was small enough and they, you know, were scrappy enough that they had been doing it for other companies. And of course, then there were these other, then there was this other class of company that's all they did. You know, there's no Magnus Steyr branded car. They just make, you know, cars for other car companies. So, And so then we ended up with a deal with Lotus because they had a better sort of impedance match with us.
So, okay, that'll solve that end of it. But what about actually making the batteries work based off your math? You're working with literal laptop batteries, 18650, the gold standard of the lithium ion battery cells. So you just have to make packs out of them and then shove them in the cars.
You know,
it
turns out that occurs. Obviously, there's a lot more to that. So
sure.
850s at the time were the only industry standard sort of cell, and I think that's still really the case. Everyone now, for the most part, has gone to various lithium polymer technologies because they want the battery shaped, you know, to be at the bottom of the laptop or, you know, wrapped around the cell phone or, you know, whatever. At the time, every laptop had these 18650s in it, and every camcorder, which were those separate, they're like cell phones except they didn't have phones. They just had video recorders, very strange things. All of them were using these 18650s, and this was really one of Martin's insights. As we were looking for how to make the packs, we were familiar with the 18650s from the ebook days, And you know, the thing is, he says, well, these, you know, let's just use these. I said, well, it's insane. You know, it's going to be thousands of them. But the more we thought about it, that was a great thing because they were a commodity. They're made by dozens of different companies around the world. Not all of them are the same quality, but they're all pretty much the same, you know, they're the same form factor. And that's what you want. If you're a buyer, you want to have lots of choices. You don't want to be locked into one particular weird format that only one company makes. You want to have lots of competition, all beavering away to make those 18650s cheaper and better for you. So the whole sort of chicken and egg problem around specialized automotive batteries goes away because we're just buying these laptop batteries. Now, it turns out that laptop batteries need to be handled very carefully when you combine a whole bunch of them together. And the battery companies really didn't want us to do that.
So, they didn't want you to tinker with them at all.
Well, they did not want us to put more than seven of them together, and because there is a chance that there will be a fire. If you mistreat them, you can get them to essentially, you know, catch fire. They don't explode, but they kind of catch fire, and then if you're really not careful, that fire can spread to adjacent cells. And Sony quite famously had a whole set of laptops that would spontaneously, you know, burst into flames this way because their charging circuit was messed up. I think it was, I don't know if it was a charging circuit or if it was a chemistry problem in their battery, but they had this giant, very expensive recall. So the battery companies were extremely sensitive to having lots of these because you could imagine if you put a lot of them together, you know, that could be a really big fire if you weren't careful. So they really didn't want us to do that. But we eventually convinced them that actually we knew more about how to keep their batteries safe than they did. And we finally got, you know, a supply agreement worked out. It turns out that if you go to a sales guy and you say, you know, we think that, you know, if you ask a sales guy, what is your fantasy customer for your batteries? And they say, oh, you know, they would have, you know, three of these cells in a laptop and two of them in a camcorder and two more of them in an extra battery for their camcorder. And we go, okay, great. So like seven cells, you know, something around there.
Per user,
Per user, per customer, is your fantasy customer. They go, oh, yeah. And you're selling lots of them. They're selling, you know, hundreds of millions of these things. And I said, well, you know, we think that your market's 1,000 times larger.
Because how many would be in every car?
Nearly 7,000. And you know, if you can convince even a relatively low-level salesman that their addressable market is really 1,000 times larger, you will get a call from the CEO of that company, no matter how big that company is, asking about, what's this thing about 1,000 times larger market? Mm-hmm. So we eventually convinced several of the battery companies to work with us. And it helped that we had by far the best safety data, because nobody else had really tried it. Nobody else, they had this sort of knee-jerk reaction that you don't put very many of them together. And it, you know, if you don't know what you're doing, you can, in fact, you know, hurt yourself. But if you think about it and do the right things, you can actually make them quite safe.
So you guys are starting down the road in this amazing sort of engineer hacker ethos of, well, let's just make it work. Let's do the math. The math is right. Let's make it work. One thing we haven't talked about is raising money and convincing people, hey, we're doing a car company. And not only are we doing a car company, we're doing an electronic vehicle car company. So tell me, what was it like? I believe you guys actually go to Sand Hill Road because that's what you know. You come from the Valley. What was it like to try to pitch a car company to VCs on Sand Hill Road?
Oh, we were considered crazy. I mean, you know, but that's, you know, so one of the things, if you raise enough money enough times, you know, you're used to people saying no. I mean, that's just the way it is. It's almost always, you know, they turn you down. So that didn't bother us too much. What we did do, though, is we knew some VCs that that were friendly to us. I mean, they kind of liked us, but we knew that they wouldn't invest in us. Because, like, for example, their fund only invested in internet routing. Was one of them.
Right? Oh,
they only did internet infrastructure sort of things.
Or biotech or something like that.
Or biotech, exactly. So we knew that we were completely outside of their investment space. And we called them up and we said, hey, you know, we have this crazy idea and we want to pitch you guys. We know that you can't invest. So this isn't, you know, this isn't a pitch that you're going to have to actually respond to and stuff. But, you know, what we would like is just the feedback. And we weren't really sure what they would say, but it turns out that if all day, all you hear are pitches for, you know, internet routing startups, if somebody says, I've got this crazy idea about, you know, high-performance electric sports cars, all the partners will show up if you provide lunch and hear this, because they want to hear something other than a router pitch. And so they gave great feedback as to things we had to change. And they asked, you know, quite insightful questions, which, you know, we thought we had all of our ducks in a row and all of our answers figured out. But, it, you know, they would ask these questions like, oh, shoot, I don't really know that. Or they would challenge us on some of the numbers and we wouldn't have answers to. So then we go back and sort of rethink and retool. And that's how we honed our pitch before we actually used our sort of silver bullets to get in with these VCs that we thought might fund us. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, you only get kind of one chance, really. So we wanted to make sure that we had all the answers. So then starting in January, we were doing this sort of over the holidays of 2003. And then starting in January, we actually, you know, went down Sand Hill Road. And, you know, VCs are always polite, or at least most of them are. And we quickly discovered that we could pretty much convince a few people in the VC firm that this was a cool idea and worth funding. But in a large firm, there's lots of partners, and you typically need sort of unanimous consent to make the investment. The investments are, you know, pioneered by, or, you know, sort of championed by one partner. But ultimately, you need everyone to at least say okay, as opposed to, you know, you're insane, we're not doing this. And the larger the partnership, the harder that was, because there would always be one person that said, you know, this is insane. So we very quickly targeted smaller funds that only had a couple of partners, because we figured, you know, we could probably get a couple people to say yes. Mm-hmm. And we lined up money from SDL Ventures and Compass Technology Partners, because they were, you know, relatively small funds with only, you know, one or two deciding partners. And of course, you know, various friends and family. And then we were in March, we pitched Elon as a super angel. Mm-hmm. And Elon liked the idea, and we went down to SpaceX and, you know, did the pitch, and SpaceX at that time hadn't launched anything yet. It was a, you know, total small little startup doing, you know, it was you know, years from their first launch attempt. And he looked at it, he says, you know, I like this. I'm really concerned about oil consumption as well. I get the vision. I love the, you know, where you're coming into the market. I'm in. And so he led the Series A round. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, was on the board after that, obviously.
Whenever I need to do financial research for this show, for instance, during tech earnings season, when I have to analyze how various companies' stocks have been performing, I only ever turn to our sponsor today, Yahoo Finance. For more than 25 years, Yahoo Finance has been the brand behind every great investor. Whether you're a seasoned investor or are looking for that extra guidance, Yahoo Finance gives you all the tools and data you need in one place. They are the number one finance destination, producing a holistic look at the financial news cycle, including breaking news, original editorial perspectives, analyst ratings, independent research, customizable charts, and so much more. Securely link your brokerage accounts for a unified view of your wealth, including 401k and other investments. A comprehensive perspective is what sets apart great investors, and it's how Yahoo Finance ensures you have the insights to look at your wealth in its entirety. With a community of over 90 million users each month, their real strength is helping you on your way to financial success. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit the brand behind every great investor, yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com. That's yahoofinance.com.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's Byte.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Was it just that simple? You pitch and he's in, or did he do a lot of due diligence? Like,
oh, he pestered. So I'm simplifying that whole process. So we pitched on a Friday or a Thursday or something, and then I was in Washington D.C. all weekend, so I was, you know, sort of peppered with questions by Elon, you know, over the weekend, and then into the beginning of the next week, and then I think Thursday or Friday of that next week, because I was back by then, we went back down to L.A. And he, you know, asked some more questions, and we told him, you know, whatever, and he says, okay, you know, that. Yeah, he had clearly checked us out as well, and he'd looked at our backgrounds, and you know, and we had answered all the questions apparently well enough that, and he says, "Okay, I'm in."
Yeah,
and then, and it takes about a month, you know, typically from that point to get the paperwork all done and the money.
It just seems such an example of, you know, it was so right up his alley, an idea that he would have been primed and ready to be interested.
Well, exactly, yeah, and you know, it was. It was exactly up his alley, and that's one of the reasons why, you know, he was a very supportive, and, you know, originally investor, obviously, and now, you know, you can argue he's been a very successful CEO for Tesla, because it really was aligned with his interests to begin with. And he, at some point, he said, you know, if I wasn't doing SpaceX, this is an example of something that I would be doing. You know, this is the right, exactly the right approach in the right market, and doing the right thing, you know, for the right reasons. And it's, you know, hopefully going to be, you know, successful financially.
We'll get into a little bit of the step-by-step, but one more thing on the fundraising thing, because I liked this as an idea. Every step along, when you would come out with a mule or a prototype or whatever, that's what you would use to raise more money. You would literally take the vehicle around and drive people around in it and then ask them for Series B, Series C.
Well, so the thing is, let's say that you need, you know, $60 million for some project. It's incredibly rare, even now, that you're going to, and it's not even really desirable to raise that money all at once. Because if you're just a couple guys with a PowerPoint, your company isn't going to be worth very much. So to take the 60, 70 million at once, even if you could get somebody to agree, they're going to own the whole company at the end, because, you know, the initial value of your idea just can't be very high. So what you do is you tend to you raise money in tranches, which is easier, although it takes you're always raising money in a way. But so you raise a little bit of money at first, and you say, this is the big technical risk, which in our case, it was really around the battery, because that was the thing that everyone always asked about. Can you really get this kind of energy density in a battery like that? And can you really make it safe? So, that was the goal of the first tranche of money. So the deliverable at the end of that was that we would have a mule, a vehicle that doesn't reproduce in the car industry. You take a little bit of one company, or a little bit of one car and a little bit of another car. It's a rolling test platform that doesn't reproduce. And we made a mule, and at that time we used a Lotus Elise because we already were on trend to a deal with Lotus. And we built our battery pack, and then we used an AC propulsion motor and inverter, because it was really the battery pack that we were focused on. And we were working on our own motor and inverter, but it was not, we knew we could do the motor and inverter, that, those had been around. I mean, Nikola Tesla invented AC induction motors, 100 years ago. So we knew that was going to be possible, right? The most common motors, electric motors in existence. The thing that was a little bit unclear is whether we could really retire the risk around the battery pack. So you build the car, and by and large, the VC community is not hugely imaginative. So when you come and you can give whatever it is that you're trying to raise money for, if you have a demo that really shows off what you're doing, it helps investors get comfortable with the idea. So in this case, we had this little yellow Lotus, and you got into it, and it took off incredibly quickly, and was silent and beautiful and really fun. And we got that, and as soon as we were able to drive that, literally, we got it working, like midnight. The next morning, we had a board meeting. The board is there. Elon is there. We show it off, and we're not running out of money, but it's time to raise money again. And we had retired that risk from an investor's perspective. They look and they go, wow, the battery system is going to work. Here's an example of it working. And wow, it was such a rush to ride in that thing. It was a much more visceral experience. So then it was easier to raise money. So then we had some meetings with other VCs at that time. We were still in stealth mode, and they came in from Chicago. They saw the place. They heard the song and dance. They all rode in the car, and the partnership was only three or four partners, and they said, hey, can we borrow your conference room for a few minutes? We have a meeting we have to do. I said, oh, yeah, sure. So they're going to be on the plane back to Chicago, and they come out of the meeting about 20 minutes later, and they said, we're in. That was our partnership meeting. That was our Monday partnership meeting we just had. And it was because they had ridden in it. I think it proved to them that this was possible, and that it was unlike anything that they had been in. I mean, this wasn't some golf cart. This was a mule. I mean, the specs on the final car were much more impressive. But we knew, this was the proof of concept that it was going to be something that was really going to be great to have.
Well, so much of your story is about that, convincing people, and later on in the press and things like that electric vehicles aren't golf carts. In fact, they're better sports cars than you've ever ridden in your life. it's such a great position to be in when the product itself is the thing that wins people over.
Well, that's the goal. I mean, that's always the goal. You want your product to be the thing that tells the story. Mm-hmm. And you see the product and you go, oh, I get it. I want to be part of this.
Okay, I'm gonna skip a couple steps here for time purposes. But I another thing that I love about your story is, tell me the fun of crash testing, because usually engineers in Silicon Valley don't get to throw their product against the wall and see what happens.
Well, it's actually incredibly impressive, because we did not use a lot of traditional car engineers because most of the car industry is not geared to Silicon Valley's sort of speed and mentality, and also a lot of it's wrapped around internal combustion engines and emissions and stuff like that, which we didn't have any need for. the one sort of sub-discipline that was incredibly impressive to me is the crash people. And you hire them. I mean, there are companies that's what they do, right? So these people had experience with the Lotus Elise. And it was, you know, similar enough that their models, you know, kind of, you know, were not super hard to adapt. And it was all, you know, okayed with, you know, through the Lotus, you know, IP department. So they came and they, you know, take all these measurements, and they sit and model it, and they, you know, they don't take measurements, they just grab the CAD files and they do everything, and they make a couple tweaks. And what's incredibly impressive is that they're able to say, again, you know, this incredible predictive power of mathematics. Wow, you know, you might have trouble on the side impact on the doors, so we're going to want a special test for that because we want to make sure that that's going to be safe. Because we think that's a little bit, that's a little on the edge, but everything else should pass. And we, you know, are getting these very expensive engineering prototypes. So at some point you say, okay, pencils down. We know what we're going to make, and you go and you make some, and it's sort of production intent. So this is really what we think we're going to make, but it's not production process. And you make 10 of them, and they're all, you know, largely identical except for color. And you crash some of them. And what you're really doing in those crashes is validating their computer models. Because in their computer models, they've crashed it many, many, many times. And they, you know, they've crashed it with all kinds of different manufacturing variances and to make sure it's always going to pass. Every car will. But you know, how valid is the model? So we go and you spend an enormous amount of money taking it to, again, this is all part of this ability to do this because everything has been outsourced. In the olden days, those crash test people the crash modeling people would have been captive to GM or whatever.
Right.
And we wouldn't have been able to go to a place that does crash tests because those were owned by Ford or whatever, you know, only for Ford. But instead, you know, we went to one of the several independent houses that did that kind of thing. And this particular one, I think, was Siemens in Germany or Austria. I can't remember where it was anymore. It's somewhere in Europe. And they have these very high speed cameras and this incredible setup, and they take, you know, we have each one of these engineering prototypes costs hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars to make, and they basically accelerate them into concrete walls. And when they're not accelerating them into concrete walls, they're taking these like rams, like out of medieval, you know, things that storm castles, and they're smashing into, you know, they're computer controlled and accelerated rams, but they're smashing those into the car. And of course, they've instrumented the car like crazy. They're looking at the G forces that happen on the driver and the passenger, and you know what happens to the car itself. But and what you see is millions of dollars being just destroyed in front of your eyes in incredibly vivid, super high speed HD. You get these beautiful videos back that just make your heart sink in the sense of everything that's being, you know, lost. What is incredible to me, though, is you see these tremendous crashes, and then the crash test dummies look pretty good. And when you look at the data from the crash test dummies, you go, "Oh, they would have, you know, walked away." It's amazing. It's one of the reasons why I won't drive an old car, is because they're really demonstrably more dangerous. The modern, you know, sort of post airbag era of crashes, you know, it really, really made a difference. And what's incredible in the modeling, you know, we do we crash these engineering prototypes, and you know, the modeling exactly predicted it. I mean, like within a few percent, they're like, "Oh yeah, okay,
everything's fine." But they still have to run the physical test anyway.
Yeah, because you really need to validate the model. Mm-hmm. Now the big guys, the GMs and Fords and stuff, they have argued for years with their lawyers that they don't have to actually do the physical crashes, because in fact, they haven't had a mismatch between, at least this is what we were told, they haven't had a mismatch between their modeling and their crashes in years and years and years. And so they argue that once it passes through the computers, it's okay. And the lawyers have always maintained, if there was ever a suit, if there was ever, you know, if you had to prove it in court, it's so much better to have, just be able to see, this is what we did. You know, we crashed four of these cars or whatever in the crash test, in the physical things, and look at, here's the videos and here's the results, that is just a much more compelling legal argument than, you know, "Oh, we played with it in the computer and it worked great." But the crash modeling people had said that they hadn't had a mismatch in years.
Mm-hmm. All right. So bring me to the product launch. Bring me to where we get the first Roadsters out to the public. February 2007, you're doing validation prototypes, but you start to run into trouble, like, for example, with the transmissions.
Right, yeah. So the engineering prototypes, what you do is you drive them into the ground, basically. And you drive them into the ground as quickly as you can. So you do all kinds of tests. You put them in, you know, ice. You know, you literally drive around in frozen lakes in cold weather. But those are, of course, test tracks that you hire out, and it's all professionally done. It's something that wouldn't have been possible in an era where the car companies owned everything. And they have these durability tracks that are like cobblestone race tracks, and they have drivers that do nothing but beat the cars to hell on these tracks. So you're trying to get 10 years and 100,000 miles of wear and tear in as short a period of time as you can. And stuff flies off the car and breaks all the time. And everything that breaks, you do a big analysis as to, you know, why did this fail? I mean, this shouldn't have failed. So you do this incredible sort of analysis going back. And the one thing at that time, in order to meet our top speed and our acceleration parameters, we had a two-speed manual transmission, which we didn't think would be hard. The car industry is making two-speed transmissions, or is making manual transmissions for 100 years. So we contracted with a small transmission house. Now, we had a lot more torque than they were used to, but we figured, you know, how hard is that? It's just some gears. It was not something that we really focused on because we had a supplier that we thought could deliver. And their transmissions just didn't work. They couldn't shift, which was unfortunate for us. So that was a problem, but we caught that in the sort of engineering prototype land. As we're feeding all these thousands of design changes in for the production cars, we also, you know, realized the transmission wasn't going to work. So we then contracted with another, a much bigger by this time. We had a lot more money, and people knew what we were doing, a much higher profile, with another auto supplier to build transmissions. And we spent lots and lots of money with them. And their transmission project was a little late. So meanwhile, we're doing all this other testing, and we just have some cobbled together, you know, sort of mule, if you will, transmissions. So we can do all the rest of the other testing, except for the transmissions. And we finally get the first articles on what we hope to be the production transmissions. And they look kind of good initially, but we put them on the durability track. We put them on our dynos, which are the test fixtures in the lab. And they all begin to break, and they all break in different ways. And that's not good. Yeah. If they all break in one way, you can kind of deal with it.
You can isolate it, yeah.
Right, but they're really not breaking well. So at that point, we were kind of, and it, by this point, everything else is done. You know, we've gotten through all of the, what are called FMVSS, Federal Motor Vehicle Safety Standards. All of them have been completed. We are ready, essentially, to ship, except we don't have transmissions at work. And this nearly killed the company. It was also in 2007, 2008. The money financing was beginning to get a little skittish, and here we have this huge... It was the first milestone that we really missed in a big way. Everything else might have been a little bit, you know, more expensive or a little bit later, but we had... conscious decisions along the way that did that. You know, we decided to make the car better, or we decided to change the specs. It was everything along the way was sort of much more conscious. This one was just a screw up. It failed. So, and it wasn't something. It wasn't in our core competency. You know, that we just didn't consider it to be something that we had to. You know, we were dealing with one of the largest transmission makers in the world. They should be able to make a transmission that works, right? We didn't really. We didn't understand how dangerous that was. Anyway, so that was a very, very dark and bleak time for us. But as it turned out, of course, Moore's Law, thankfully, is ticking along. And the IGBTs, which are the switching transistors in the inverter that synthesize the waveform, International Rectifier, I believe, was our supplier, they had a new version that was just coming out, and it was more efficient. Not a whole lot, you know, they're incredibly efficient, but this was more efficient. And what that means is that you can put more power through without them overheating. So suddenly, by replacing these IGBTs and making a few other changes, we could increase the power that we could deliver to the motor more than we thought possible, more than was possible with the existing transistors. And what that allowed us to do was to increase the horsepower and the torque so we could get to a one-speed transmission, which is just a one, it's just a reduction.
Right, right.
And that, the car industry, and actually our new supplier was awesome. They came through for us and did an amazing job, and record speed produced a beautiful transmission. And that's what we ended up shipping. But we shipped it late. We actually shipped some number of cars. I can't remember how many, but our customers have been waiting for years. So we asked them, you can take delivery now, but what we'll have to do is, but the transmission that we're going to have is just, it's just something cobbled together, and it's not going to give you the final spec performance. And then in about, sometime over the next 6 months, we'll bring the car back in for service, and we'll replace the transmission and the inverter or whatever else that needs to be replaced in the drivetrain to make it meet the specifications we promised. And I think all of the customers said, that's fine. We'd rather have it now and be driving it around. So we started delivering cars, and then I think we called it Rev 1.5 or something of the drivetrain. And then we ultimately, when the new transmissions came out and the new inverters were in place, we then just retrofitted the ones that we had delivered.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
So Moore's Law really saved you guys.
It always does,
Yeah.
just when you can't really fit that last bit of code into the space, it turns out that the memory chips are four times more dense for the same price, and you upgrade.
Well, and so you guys do start to deliver cars, I think, in June of 2008, and I know it's around this time that you and Martin both leave the company, but can you tell me how close, because you mentioned this is when the financial crisis is hitting, how close to oblivion was Tesla around the financial crisis period?
Well, when the transmission was, when we couldn't deliver cars, I think it was a near-death experience, and, for the company. And it was really, the existing investors, Elon especially, sort of ponied up, and at a time when it was really difficult to do that. And they, funded enough to get us to the next milestone, which was delivering. And then once the cars began to be delivered, and people were, we were getting great reviews and people were really getting excited about them, then the next funding round was easier, essentially, because, we had really retired a lot of risk. We were shipping cars at the time. But that was a near-death experience for the company, for sure.
So I'm going to wrap up. There's other podcasts and interviews that look towards the future, and I kind of want to always focus on lessons from the past, because that's what this history show is about. But I've got two questions that will kind of be a little future and a little of both. I think that a competitive advantage that you guys might have had when you launched was that you were coming in at the end of that first moment of electronic vehicles. GM gives up on the EV1, and so you kind of have the field to yourselves.
Correct.
And then was there any thought that, like, okay, so we'll, because you mentioned that you were in quiet mode for a long time, that, okay, once we perfect this technology, then everyone will come to us and we'll teach the entire automobile industry how to do EV. Mm-hmm. Was that part of your thinking at the beginning?
So what we had, you know, we didn't know, you know, obviously you don't know how everyone's going to respond, but we figured that if we were successful, we'd do a couple of things. One is that we would change people's perceptions of electric cars, that, you know, they weren't these lame golf cart things. It would be, even though that it was an aspirational product and that it was very expensive, you know, that people would say, oh, you know, if I ever get rich, I want one of those electric cars, as opposed to, you know, those lame things. It would be this aspirational product, which we thought would enable the whole market, you know, moving forward. But in terms of the other car companies, what our sort of expectations were was that we would release this, the car companies would sort of wake up and go, wow, you know, this is really possible. This can be done. These can be really compelling vehicles. And there would be some amount of space race, basically, to get into the electric car business. And we would have to deal with that, you know, as it went. And we could deal with that in a couple of ways. We might be suppliers to some of those car companies. It was possible that, you know, there would be some kind of, we figured we would have more experience and more sort of electrically driven miles than anybody else in history by the time, you know, this became a hot thing. So we would be the world's experts in that. And that would be a good place to be if all the car companies were trying to be in that space. So there would be lots of potential deals. There was, you know, who knows, an acquisition. I mean, there was a lot of different ways of going. We'd have lots of options. And then we would move into a more mass market car, which would be a sedan. The sedan market is much, much larger than the sports car market. So ultimately, you know, the Model S was where that's the high volume, you know, that's a much, much bigger volume than the sports car. But that's a very crowded space to be in and very difficult to be in. So we figured, you know, as we move towards that, we would have lots of options. There would be partnership options. There would be, you know, we would have lots of room to maneuver. And if the car industry just really decided to be very competitive with us, we also felt that Silicon Valley could outcompete them because they just move at a much slower pace. I don't think any of us really imagined that they moved as glacially slow as they really are. I mean, they're just now finally beginning to get with the program, and still, you know, their technology just really isn't as good. I mean, and, you know, they have huge resources and tremendous experience, certainly in making cars. And I certainly didn't expect them to take this long to sort of wake up and begin to take electric cars seriously and begin to produce competitive products, which I think has played very well for Tesla.
Yeah, obviously. And, you know, sort of building off of that, and I'm not asking this to be a troll, and I'm not asking you to specifically throw anybody under the bus, but because as listeners of this show know, I know a lot of people in the automotive industry, but I come from tech, and there's this existential argument back and forth between these two worlds. So my final question would just be, because you've lived it, you've experienced it, the difference between the car people and the tech people, and if Detroit has to move in Silicon Valley's direction, and if Silicon Valley is infiltrating Detroit's game, what have you learned about the difference between car people and tech people, and the way they look at the world and their philosophy of product and innovation and things like that?
That's a good question. And there's a bunch of dimensions to it. Mm. One is, I think, that it isn't so much car people versus tech people. It's much more really giant old companies, whether it's in the book industry, like we dealt with before, or probably almost any industry. If you've been around for a long time and you've done things the same way for a long time, you get very used to it. And you're making money. You know, it's not like you're, you know, failing. And there's a huge resistance to taking risks and trying stuff new, because that could have impact, you know, your division's numbers or your career, and it just makes it very hard for innovative ideas to infiltrate these big companies. In Silicon Valley, we don't tend to have you know, we don't have any 100-year-old companies that are big out here. I mean, we only have a handful, you know, the Intels and the Hewlett Packards and stuff that have been around for a long time. And, you know, they go through periods of sort of struggle. I think, you know, HP currently is struggling with that problem, and Intel to some degree. But they grew up in this environment, and they're deep into this innovative culture. And I think that, you know, the car industry, which used to be very innovative and creative when they were smaller, but when they got very large and very content at making the same old thing every year, I think that is what makes them sort of ripe for, you know, clever Silicon Valley startups. And as I said, I don't think it's really a car thing versus a Silicon Valley thing. I think it's just a Silicon Valley thing versus really old, big, you know, industrial companies.
Well, yeah, and when I've told people that I was going to talk to you today, they said, well, that's not internet history. And I said, well, no, what's so fascinating to me as a famously, you know, software is eating the world, how internet technology, digital technology is going into everything. And as you say, it's not just about any industry that's done things a certain way for even centuries and how it's being disrupted. And you've lived it twice now with two different industries. Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Mark, for coming on the show and remembering all that.